Last week, I received a text that a few members of the congregation were here on a Saturday cleaning up and repainting the peace pole that rests by our front steps. How many folks know that we have a peace pole? It is surrounded by the beautiful butterfly bush that's right outside my window. It's just perfect. Words painted in different languages and suggesting an arena of calm and tranquility. Now, for folks who are new to our community, or for those of you who have forgotten it so far in the distant spring, 2016 is our centennial year, and we have spent a lot of time celebrating and honoring that centennial year in the spring, but it continues through our fall and early winter. So for the next few months, I thought it would be appropriate and fun to take a look at each of the five candles of fellowship, those five candles that set our intentions each Sunday, and which better to start from than being a peace site. So I loved that the peace pole was getting a bit of a makeover in time for this sermon, because as it was being cleaned, I realized that I needed to come clean. Over the last 2+ years of hearing those words each Sunday with you all, we are a peace site, I have wondered, what does that mean? I have wondered what feeling it elicits for each of you who hear those words or see that pole, and I have cautiously and quietly asked those tiny but daunting questions. How? And why? And still? I was introduced to the notion and sentiment of peace from a very early age, and right inside a UU religious education classroom, Ginny Cornell was my RE teacher. Sitting around a big circle table, she passed out those large pieces of construction paper and asked us to draw a picture of the thing that we believed was most dear, most true to Unitarian Universalism. My parents kept that drawing for decades, I will have you know, and I remember how proud I was of their pride in my stick figures and wise beyond my 5 years insight into faith and what would save the world. Tolerance, I wrote in big rainbow shaded letters, and below it, a pink colored girl holding hands with a black stick figured boy holding hands with a brown skinned ponytail child too. This is what I grew up believing our faith offered, and somewhat humorously offered, better, smarter, and kinder than any other religion: tolerance. And through tolerance, that arm's length, non-engaged, no relationship, you over there and me over here, tolerance, there would be peace. A happy sun and green grass with blooming flowers shooting out from every inch of that flat, free horizon. Peace was equated with calm, tolerant, or tolerated diversity. Peace was the Quaker pacifist. No fighting, no arms, no engagement is how that was interpreted to mean. But those five letters mean a very different thing to a very many different people. Many of you will recall that last April, a Catholic priest named Father Daniel Berrigan died at the age of 94. Who knows Berrigan's name? Are we familiar with him? If not, dive into this man's life. He is remembered most commonly as one of the Catonsville Nine, who in 1968 broke into the draft board in Catonsville, Maryland, took almost 400 draft files of those who were next to be sent to Vietnam, dumped the files into a wire basket, and then poured homemade napalm over them and set them on fire. Berrigan's name echoed throughout my seminary's halls as often as Amos or Moses, Jesus or King. Through him, I was taught the devotion, bravery, and audacity that justice required. And rather uncomfortably, it was also his napalm works, his blunt words, his deeply engaged push and pull of both the heart and system that my once lovely, simple and pretty notion of peace was turned on its head. "Some stood up once and sat down," begins Berrigan's poem. "Some walked a mile and walked away. Some stood up twice, then sat down. It's too much," they cried. "Some walked 2 miles, then walked away. I've had it," they cried. "Some stood and stood and stood. They were taken for fools. They were taken for being taken in. Some walked and walked and walked. They walked the earth. They walked the waters. They walked the air. Why do you stand?" they were asked. "And why do you walk?" "Because of the children," they said. "And because of the heart. And because of the bread. Because the cause is the heart's beat and the children born and the risen bread." We here at UUCWC are a peace site and have been since 1983 because we were designated as such by the National Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, and it's today known as Peace Action, which works for the education and action for peace and disarmament worldwide. Money was given out of the bequest of Vera Hancock, a matriarch of this community, whose audacious spirit is why we have a letter from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on our wall, thanking her, responding to Vera for her letter to him, in which she offered this, her community, in the 60s as a community of allies in the civil rights movement. Vera's life was bold, and her community encouraged it. Today, in lighting our candle for peace, we still celebrate her work and her spirit, but in a rather slippery way. We've taken liberties over the years to leave this word peace and this designation of being a peace site ambiguous. We've allowed that word to go without dissection or definition, saying nothing of action or charge. And this ambiguity risks leaving us rather ambiguous in what we offer to a wounded and hurting world, in how we participate in the healing or bearing witness to the grief. Will we be a peace site that offers refuge from, or a peace site that requires creative engagement in? Now, I know that for many of you, this is not why you came to church thinking that we were going to be talking about peace, even though somebody from the choir did say that this is what they were expecting of me, if not harder. I want to be really clear. I'm not asking for any homemade napalm at the end of this service. But what I am wondering is, what does this designation require? Father Berrigan had a very specific answer to such a question, and I offer you his words as a man, if you remember, who I described as being rather blunt, rather spirited in his offerings. He says, "I think of the good, decent, peace-loving people I have known by the thousands, and I wonder, how many of them are so afflicted with the wasting disease of normalcy that even as they declare for peace, their hands reach out with an instinctive spasm in the direction of their loved ones, in the direction of their comforts, their home, their security, their income, their future, their plans. That 20-year plan of family growth and unity, that 50-year plan of decent life and honorable natural demise. Of course, let us have peace, we cry, but at the same time, let us have normalcy. Let us lose nothing. Let our lives stand intact. Let us know neither prison nor ill repute nor disruption of ties. And because we must encompass this and protect that, and because at all costs, our hopes must march on schedule, and because it is unheard of that in the name of peace a sword shall fall, disjoining that fine and cunning web that our lives have woven, because it is unheard of that good men and women should suffer injustice or families be sundered or good repute be lost, because of this, we cry peace and there is no peace. There is no peace because there are no peacemakers, he says. There are no makers of peace because the making of peace is at least as costly as the making of war, at least as exigent, at least as disruptive, at least as liable to bring disgrace and prison and death in its wake. I wouldn't rank very high on a list of people that impressed Father Berrigan. I don't think I disagree with a word he offers, and yet I will tell you here that I fear disgrace and I have pretty much no interest in prison or death. I sit with those realities, and I try to be fair to myself knowing them. I pray there will be those braver than I, forgiving of my spasmed reach for my loved ones, and I put my faith wholeheartedly in them, trying desperately to not turn away from the fight they risk themselves for, while I learn and weep and grow from the comfort of my places of privilege. There must be some way in between shadowed letters of tolerance and the costly warlike making of peace. For we cannot sit in the refuge of this place and offer it as a community that just does not sound like the cries of Charlotte's streets. We can't do that as a thing of pride, at least, and we cannot do so as a claim of peace. For too long, we have aligned ourselves with the palatable stories of dead heroes, because many of us fear or do not understand the stories of those who are dying. We quote King and remember proudly his time in UU pulpits and his eulogy of our ministers, and we put Rosa Parks on a stamp because she sat politely. But Colin Kaepernick can't take a knee. And we forget or choose not to tell that after Rosa Parks sat, there was destruction and lynching in the streets for weeks. We rarely quote King's grave disappointment in the white moderate, who he said is more devoted to order than justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension. We sing De Colores, but rarely hear it in the tongues of the Spanish farm workers who used it as a rallying cry. Perhaps our work for peace now, our bullhorns, our creative peacemaking in between that tolerance and warlike making will be in learning and sharing the truth of our peacemakers more bold than we. Peacemakers who, in their passing and as time distances us from their works, have been watered down and sanitized, whose images have been left to polite seat-taking or from behind pulpits, rather than also in the looted streets. Perhaps our front lines, our peace sites, will be the local high schools or the company offices or, heaven forbid, the crossings room in uncomfortable conversations with people we respect, with those we love, in places and in relationships we just rather not disrupt. Now, I admit that at least for me, this all seems quite quiet and small compared to Father Berrigan, for better or worse, compared to the despair of Charlotte, compared to what the world needs of every single one of us right now. And it is small. And I hate that. I hate that it is so uncomfortable to do such seemingly minute things, not because they aren't important or bold enough, but because of the fragility I feel in a conversation. And that fragility begs me to wonder what I hold dear, to what I am indifferent, and for what I would walk or stand. This month's theme of covenant, of who and what we are bound to, asks a haunting question. It asks, whose are you? Not who are you, but whose are you? My quick responses, I think, would be rather obvious. I am my beloved's, my son's, the friendships that feed and need me. In large part, I am the congregations I serve, but not without personhood or boundaries. I am the earths and the universes to use and move through and with. Whose am I? It's quite a lovely promise of connection that I am bound to and by. But those responses leave out the hardships. Those responses keep the voiceless silent and the ugly unseen. There is easy accountability within those answers. For who doesn't want to be bound to their spouse, child, or community? Who wouldn't want to work on the renewal of those relationships when things get tough? The web is far larger than I wish it to be some days. For I am also Terrence Crutcher's and Keith Scott's. I am also the systems that fail to train our police responsibly. I am also Vera Hancock's and the children of this congregation who will expect us to give them a site in which its gatherers are moved to create engaged and deeply compassionate peace. Why do you stand, they asked, and why do you walk? Because of the children, because of the heart, and because of the bread. We are a peace site. It is not passive, and it is not past tense, and it is certainly not without disruption. So whose are you? May the reflections of our hearts brighten and embolden the path for our lives. May it be so, and blessed be.